Yes.
Okay. First question.
Anastasia. Already, what's the first? Who's the first question? That's you. Okay. Can you say the last sentence again? Is it possible to?
Is it possible to obtain such a superb form of gravity from strings to equilibrium?
Well, I'm not very much at home with the super theories and the super conformance theories, so I guess people like Mike Duff would be in a better position to answer that question. So far, I only rarely touch supersymmetry or supergravity in this kind of work. So, but it's a very natural thing, of course. It's a natural thing, of course, to try to extend these ideas to supersymmetric and supergravity scenarios. But I haven't done that. So I wonder if, I don't know if Mike Duff is here, but he might be able to comment on this. Other question? What's happening?
Is this okay?
Yes.
The only quantum theory I'm aware of that is conformally invariant at the quantum level is the maximally supersymmetric conformal supergravity. That's not probably the one you want for your purposes, but it has the virtue of where the anomalies cancel. It does appear as the low energy limit, not of the conventional strings, but some twister-type string that Witten and others dreamed up. And they didn't like it because it violates unitarity. But that's as much as I can tell you in an answer to your question.
Thank you. So a possible idea one can have here is to use that as a zeroth approximation. We know nature is not obviously superconformally invariant. There is something breaking it. So what you could do is then add things to the theory which are not conformally invariant and use those to make a more, physically structured model of nature. And my way of looking at gravity is I could make any theory conformally invariant in a trivial sense at first. Then I apply my own physical conditions to make it non-trivial. One could think of applying that theme in combination with what we know about superconformal theories. So start with the superconformal theory, which is approximately, which has some deviations added to it, some disturbance, which is very small, for instance, we still have the hierarchy problem, which is a very severe problem, which few people, I think nobody really understands. So where do these 20 orders of magnitude come from between what we have as a standard model now and the Planck scale? So one possibility would be to take a large N superconformal theory and then add one single scalar which doesn't belong there just to break the whole lot and then see how the algebra survives in a 1 over N or 1 over N squared approximation. But that sounds ugly, so we have to search for something smarter than that. But for model making, certainly superconformal theories will be very interesting.
Zoller?
Max Zoller, KIT Germany. I have a question about what you said, that conformal symmetry must be spontaneously broken. Have you given thought to how this, what mechanism could break this symmetry? And do you introduce a new field like the Higgs and the standard model, or do you have some other mechanism in mind? And as in your conformal symmetric, conformally symmetric theory, you have scale invariance. How does the breaking scale enter?
Well, you're precisely touching upon the point. The conformal theory itself has no scale, not in terms of the G hat fields, but only in the combination omega squared G hat. That thing is, of course, what we call metric today, and that has scale. So, so the conformal theory I arrive at is one which is deceptively trivial. So, in a way, you say, oh, well, I scale one field up and the other field down, and I only look at the product of these two fields, then, of course, that's invariant, no big deal. That should be everybody's first reaction. And then I say, yes, well, now I see things I would otherwise not have seen, and that changes the physics. So, no, I've forgotten this. In the meantime, your question. Can you repeat?
Now, what mechanism do you have in mind? Do you need a new field like the scalar doublet?
Your question was about the so-called Higgs field. Well, this field omega, which you introduce, is already, it has a vector excitation value 1, not 0, whereas the conformal transformation properties are around, centered around its value 0. So that's exactly equivalent to the Higgs mechanism, the Brauting-Glare-Higgs mechanism in the standard model. You have a field phi, which energetically likes to have the value 1, or f, but its symmetry structure is centered around its 0 point. So we have here something similar, but also something different. The omega field, the symmetry point, that is to say where it's conformally invariant, is where it is 0, but its vacuum value is 1, or 1 over the square root of Newton's constant, something like that. And but in this case, there's no potential forcing it in that direction, because that would break, that would be an explicitly conformal symmetry breaking potential. The omega field stands all by itself. In the Higgs case, it would be the radial component of the Higgs field, but that does not stand by itself, because there's also, no, I mean the transverse component of the Higgs field, the radial component is there as well. So that's why a physical particle survives, the Higgs particle, which is the radial component of a thing where the symmetry breaking goes in the transverse directions. In the omega field, this is different. The omega field itself scales under this symmetry, so no other component is left at all. So, although, as I said, conceptually, mathematically, there are many similarities, there are also important differences. And one of them is that it doesn't quite follow the electroweak example in this sense. It's a little bit different.
So you wouldn't find a particle that is left over from symmetry?
No, you wouldn't be able to detect a particle that is as revolutionary, say, as the Higgs particle. So you won't find that, because the omega particle is its own Higgs particle, but it's entirely swallowed, if you will, by the conformal ghost. So nothing physical seems to be surviving that.
Okay, thanks. Can I ask another question? Short one?
Yes.
In your theory, you need all the beta functions to vanish, but when you go to defective theory, to the standard model at low scales, you have the running of couplings. So where precisely do the couplings start to run? Does this enter after conformal symmetry is
again,
broken or below some specific scale?
There's again an important question of language here. Mm-hmm. So the usual beta functions of the standard model, they refer to the what one could call the physical fields, which is the fields relative to this omega field, because a field has a scale dimension. A field has a dimension of a mass. And not the vector field, but a scalar field, and a spinor field has a mass raised to the 3/2. So these fields have dimension. And the fields I'm now looking at are totally featureless in that respect. So the fields that occur in a standard model are, I should say it correctly, the fields occurring in a standard model are what would be the ratios of fields in my way of saying things. Mm-hmm. So phi over omega, or psi over omega to the 3/2. Now, those scale non-trivially when you run. So the beta functions do apply to those fields, but not to the fields which are fundamentally conformal invariant. I'm at the conformal fixed point right from the beginning, but in an unusual language, the language where the method is not G-mu, but G-mu hat. So this just tells you that I'm using that method to renormalize the theory, and that's fundamentally different from what you do if you use the metric G-mu to renormalize the field theory. That's because the cutoffs of the field theory are fixed with respect to the, normally they are fixed with respect to the metric G-mu. Now they are fixed with respect to the metric G-mu hat. And that is really something totally different. For instance, the mass terms of the standard model usually don't occur directly in the beta function, only in some high order corrections or so, but the masses play only a very minor role in these beta functions. In this theory, the masses also act as dimensionless couplings, and therefore they are all associated with their own beta functions as well. Now, the masses in the standard model are very, very tiny compared to the Planck scale. Therefore, those coupling constants which represent mass are very, very tiny coupling constants. And when they run very, very slowly. So, but of course, I ask now again that their beta functions should not run at all. The beta function should be zero. I think I did say it in my talk. I should repeat that. The standard model is modified not only because I will modify its algebra, but also this omega field, little Greek omega, has to be added. And then you have to consider the beta functions, and they are different from the original ones.
Thank you very much.
Tokareva, what can you tell about the gravitational conformal anomaly? As to my knowledge, it is very hard to cancel.
Well, ordinary gravity, of course, has a scale in it, in the standard way of formulating the thing. So now, what happens is two things. I split up the metric tensor in terms of an omega energy hat. But the other thing that changes is I add a Weyl square action. And that Weyl square takes over at small distances and at high energies, and that's where you renormalize the theory. So this way I depart considerably from standard gravity. Now I'm going to look at Weyl gravity, which has a 1 over k fourth in its propagator. That also generates anomalies, but more of the kind that you have with beta functions. So I know Michael Duff is a much better expert in conformal anomalies than I am, but mostly he must have been looking at different theories than this theory, and so we have to be careful in comparing these different situations. One has to look at what anomalies could possibly the renormalization property be jeopardized, and usually they are associated to scaling, because that's what conformal symmetry is. Those are the conformal anomalies you will encounter, and so they're not quite the same as the usual ones in conventional gravity.
Okay, and one more question. Is the omega field a ghost? It has wrong kinetic sign.
Could you repeat the beginning of this?
Is the omega field a ghost?
Is there only
omega field?
The omega field, yes.
Is it a ghost?
Right. Well, yes and no. Usual sort of ambiguous answer. Yes and no, because I treat it as a physical field. However, I have added a gauge invariance. So now I can choose, as the field itself is not gauge invariant, so I can use it to fix the gauge. And that, from that moment on, it just disappears altogether. I could also fix the gauge in some other way, and I would prefer that. In this case, I have a field, a physical field, and the ghost cancels out the physical field. So nothing should be left. It is the positive ghost that would cancel negative ghost. Well, again, it's more complicated. The omega field has a wrong metric, so you could call it a ghost as well. So in ordinary gravity, this works quite well for the omega field. As you know, ordinary gravity does not have negative metric states, its difficulty is not being renormalized, but no problem with metric. Surprisingly so, because if Newton's constant had the other sign, and why does it have the sign it has? Suppose gravity were repulsive, then there would be ghosts around. Then we would have a problem. But we are lucky, as theoreticians, that God is good enough to give us a positive, attractive gravity, so now we don't have that problem.
So the omega field disappears, but the Fadeev-Popov ghost, the corresponding Fadeev-Popov ghost, is present?
Yes.
Right?
I did not mention the Fadeev-Popov ghost, but it is a very important thing. As soon as you fix the gauge in a more subtle way, such that you keep renormalizability of the theory, for instance, then you have to go into the full Fadeev-Popov procedure, and Becquerel-Westra, Tubkin symmetries you have to use to renormalize the theory properly, and all those ghosts will then be there as well.
Okay, thank you.
Kovalenko?
Where are you?
I'm here.
Yeah.
Vladimir Kovalenko, St. Petersburg State University.
Sorry, I say it again.
My name is Vladimir Kovalenko, St. Petersburg State University. I would like to ask you about this algebra. So you said that we hope that there exists a perfect algebra which does the job and satisfies this condition for beta function. But do you think that if it exists, it is a unique one? Or there is several solutions, and this would provide several landscape problem for standard model couples and masses.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I have no answer, I'm afraid. The algorithms for the beta function already at one loop is quite complex, and already at one loop, I have no way of seeing how to get models where the beta function vanishes automatically. Well, actually, it can be done. The algebra is manageable. And there's some nice extremum principles you can use for the Yukawa couplings. So for the Yukawa couplings, for the gauge couplings, it's relatively simple. The situation is clear. For the Yukawa couplings, you can write down extremum principle to find stationary point of the running, so the fixed point of where the beta function vanishes. But then there's a scalar, and its algebra is rather arbitrary, it looks, and it's very difficult to judge right away which algebra will do better than which other algebra. I have looked at that problem just in amazement, and I couldn't find a clear answer. Which algebras are better than which other algebras, and why? It's a very interesting question to ask. So one possibility I was thinking is take an algebra which contains large n numbers and then make one of the n expansions. That seems to be very worthwhile. In particular, you start with the gauge coupling constants. Oh yeah, this part is clear. You first have to compute the fixed point of the gauge couplings, then the fixed points of the Yukawa couplings, and then the fixed point of the remaining scalar-scalar couplings. And because in that order it works, at least at one loop level. So you first have to do the gauge couplings. Now, if you have a very large n, and you have one fermion too many or one too few for the beta function to vanish, take a super gauge theory, it has a vanishing beta, but now you add or you remove one fermion out of one lepton, or one scalar field out of that, or one fermion out of it, then the beta function nearly vanishes. It becomes very small. It goes like 1 over n squared. Quite small because 1 over n would have been a typical coupling constant. So the coupling expansion still converges rapidly at large n. And that could be a way of generating algebras that you can handle perturbatively. But it's still a lot of work, and I haven't even had the courage yet to start doing that kind of work.
Thank you.
Grad?
Yes, where are you there?
Dmitry Grad, St. Petersburg State University. My question is, if one tries to quantize your theory, which variables should become an operators?
Which variables should be?
Should become an operators.
I still couldn't quite understand which variables should
become an operators.
Should become operators, because the theory is easiest to understand when you are near the perturbative domains, when coupling constants are small, and masses are small compared to the Planck mass. Then everything seems to be under control, and then the fields of cells are the operators that the only operators you need. If, however, the coupling constants become large because the fixed point is not close to the origin, which depends on the algebra, then of course you have to do the usual operator trick. Then you can ask how fields transform, how operator scale, and so on. But eventually, at the fixed point, all these things scale in a pure scaling manner, as we know of fixed points of conformal theories. I'm not sure that answers your question, though.
Just what I mean, we know in usual quantum field theory, field operators should commute at the points of space-time which are separated by a space-like interval.
Yes.
Outside light cone.
Yes.
And if we make a metric to be an operator, we have a problem to define causality.
You're quite right. This is a very good reason to try to stay in the perturbative domain. For instance, this while action, which eventually generates the propagator of gravity, if that has a large coefficient in front, the propagator becomes very small and you're close to the perturbative regime. Just like in the Young-Mills case, where you can put the coupling constant in front of the F mu nu, F nu term, and you put the coupling constant in the denominator. So for a while, we should do something simpler. We saw something similar. We should investigate the case first, where the while coupling constant, as I defined it, is lambda, which was sitting upstairs. When that coupling constant is very large, then you are very close to the perturbative regime. If you're close to the perturbative regime, the problem that you mentioned formally still exists, but it doesn't show up at finite orders in perturbation expansion. So you're not yet in trouble. You will be in trouble if you try to sum the perturbation theory. And actually now I have a theorem that perhaps any theory of physics will be in trouble if you try to sum the perturbation theory, because the sum doesn't exist. Our theory is not good enough to be anything beyond perturbation expansion. I have some suspicions around that, of that sort. But that has to do with my theories of quantum mechanics, which is again a completely different chapter of physics, as it seems.
Thank you. Can I ask you a second question?
I think so, if it's time permits.
Do you consider in your theory a thermodynamics of black hole, such things like entropy or Hawking temperature?
Of course, black holes were a very important indication that something of this sort had to be happening. And as I explained that, I think, also in my lecture of last year, that to make black holes behave decently, you need something of this sort happening. And that in particular refers to Hawking radiation and the information paradox. In fact, let me see here. I had a picture. Yeah, this one. This one says that if you have two observers at the opposite side of a Hawking radiation curtain, imagine there's a horizon of a black hole, and these green objects in this thing, this green stuff here, is basically matter at the horizon being emitted as Hawking radiation. Now one observer sees the Hawking radiation, that's the outside observer who is being accelerated at that point, and he sees radiation, whereas the observer who drops into the black hole doesn't see anything. So these two observers disagree about matter at this point, and therefore they disagree about the omega functions you have to use. They disagree about what metric to use. For one observer, the metric is a flat metric. The observer who doesn't see Hawking particles thinks there's a flat metric. The observer who sees not only Hawking particles, but sees them in a pure quantum state, sees all these particles generating curvature. And therefore, because of the curvature, they end up finding a different scale factor at both sides. So In fact, you can describe Hawking radiation in such a way that it only affects the scale part of gravity. And then when you try to see how different observers look at it. So that's why the sizes of atoms for one observer looks different and for other observer looks the same. The observer who sees Hawking particles thinks that the atoms behind the Hawking screen are smaller or bigger than his own atoms are. But that's because he's looking through all these Hawking particles, which cause the optical effect when he looks at the particles behind it.
Yeah, thank you.
And the last question from Laszlo.
So my name is András Laszlo, and
where are you? Sorry.
From Wigner
can
Research.
Can you raise your hand? Oh yeah. Okay.
From Wigner Research Institute for Physics, Budapest. So I would like to ask a question that. Basically, you are choosing your dynamical variables in a type of Einstein-Hilbert type setting, except for this omega compensating field. So what would happen if you were using a Palatini type approach, like taking the covariant derivative to be independent of the metric and have the compatibility condition derived as a field equation, like in a Palatini approach? Because already on the classical level, so in a classical field level, these two approaches give slightly different field equations. So I don't think
I agree with that. If you write the metric tensor as a square of a Vierbein, that's what you mean with the Palatini approach, I presume.
Well, when you are treating the covariant derivation as an independent field quantity from the metric, and you let the compatibility conditions that the matrix derivative, covariant derivative is zero to be a field equation. Yeah? It can come out as a variational field equation. And in that case, I think that would already also solve your K to the 4 problem. Yeah?
No, I don't agree with that. What you have done is just like I had a discussion with Michael Duff about when is something just a field transformation, when is it physical. But in this case, I think you're just performing field transformations, particularly in perturbative gravity. Now, non-perturbatively, you have to be very careful, of course. But when I look at perturbative gravity, the transition from the Gmenu field to the Vierbein field is just a field transformation, which leaves all the physics invariant. And also by introducing the connection field for the internal index, so we have this Lorentz vector, that's just a function of the connection field for the metric. So if after all dust settles, you discover you're doing the same physics as before. And gravity is very robust against such modifications. Sometimes theories look different at first sight, but they actually are physically the same. They should generate the same physical particles with the same interaction properties and so on. So to have those things different, then you need some more powerful change in the physics.
Thank you.
Okay, and the very last question from Anastasius.
Hi. From what I understand, the fermionic matter interactions will have to be restricted in some way so that to cancel all scaling anomalies. I mean, you showed us that the Young-Mills kinetic terms are okay, but how would the fermionic matter interactions have to be restricted?
Oh, for a theory to be renormalized, well, also all chiral anomalies have to cancel. So now we have a situation that, we have chiral anomalies and we have conformal anomalies or scaling anomalies. Strange enough, mathematically, these have very similar properties. They're both associated with index theorems and with zero modes and so on, except one generates scaling, and in ordinary renormalizer theories, people don't care anything about that, but they get very upset when the chiral anomalies don't cancel, because then a theory is inconsistent. Now, in my case, I need all anomalies to cancel, so that includes the chiral ones and it includes the scaling ones. So, but the chiral anomalies, they're very well understood and they're relatively easy to handle. Basically, what you have to do is you have to look at the anti-commutator objects D, A, B, C of the gauge group for the left fermions and for the left, right fermions, and you have to satisfy the same algebra there. So it's relatively easy to make the anomalies cancel, And we always do that in the standard model. So I didn't even mention it, but you're quite right. That remains a condition.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we run out of time, so I think we should close this discussion.